I just want to put an advertisement out that at the end of this symposium, we will briefly be asking for volunteers to coordinate the symposium for next year. So hang around if you would, and especially if you're interested in or want to provide names of people whose arms we can twist to set this symposium up again next year. All right, the next paper is paper number 71. Open rearing systems to enhance biological control adoption in greenhouse floriculture by John Sanderson at Cornell University, and that's me, so here goes. We have been seeing this past year an uptick in the interest in biological control, active interest in biocontrol in New York greenhouse growers. Partly due to some extension efforts, but also I just think a lot of growers are seeing issues with Q biotype and with thrips resistance or difficulty controlling with conserve, which has given them more interest in alternative management strategies. So there's an actual interest in, active interest in biocontrol. So we've been trying to look at ways to enhance adoption of biocontrol. And that's really what my focus is that word adoption, using open rearing systems for that. Oops. So, from many of us who have worked with growers doing biologic control in greenhouses, there are expectations that growers have in order to adopt biocontrol. This is the same list you could have for any control tactic by itself in greenhouses. That it has to be effective. It needs to be at least cost effective, if not downright inexpensive. Simplicity is really important. These guys have enough on their mind than to worry about, we can't expect them to get as interested in bugs as we are. They're interested in A, money, B, plants. And so whatever we give them needs to be simple. And it has to be reliable and consistent. And so some of these things are what we're aiming at with this open rearing system. Now, currently, most biological control approaches in greenhouse potted and bedding plant crops, not necessarily cut flowers, but in New York, most growers are growing potted plants and bedding plants. And it is augmentated biological control. It usually involves weekly inundative releases of massive numbers of natural enemies, because the goal is to drive pest populations to undetectable levels, right? Basically, that's the goal. Extermination would be nice, but at least undetectable. And under those conditions, you really can't be guaranteed that the natural enemies are going to be able to reproduce. It's a very artificial level of hosts or prey that you're expecting them to reproduce on. And so we don't necessarily assume that the natural enemies will be reproducing in the greenhouse. Now, challenges with this approach is, well, cost. A lot of these natural enemies can be pretty expensive. We've got estimates that a single Aphidius colomani female wasp for aphid control is about 7 cents. And I can tell you how we came up with that. Includes all the costs involved. But 7 cents a piece, that's pretty expensive. The shipping costs, weekly shipments coming in, there's going to be shipping costs. We've seen a lot of difficulties, especially with some of the whitefly parasitoids in the past couple of years, of inconsistent survival of what the grower has purchased and the quality of the shipments, the overall quality. And the last thing that really can kill biological control is when growers are relying on weekly releases of natural enemies, and they get a call from an insectary saying, whoops, we didn't get our shipment this week, so we'll give you credit for next week's. Sorry, that you just lost the game if that happens. And so missed shipments cannot happen. So those are some of the challenges with getting weekly shipments in and doing inundated releases. Okay, what about an open rearing system? What are we talking about here? So a banker plant or an open rearing system, it's really a non-crop plant or other kind of resource provided to natural enemies to sustain or even increase natural enemy levels, arthropod natural enemies, in the absence of high numbers of their pestiferous prey. Basically, it keeps them going in the greenhouse. It's an in-house insectary, essentially. Some of the advantages here begin to be pretty obvious. Potentially, you've got a continuous production of natural enemies in for continuous crop protection, despite the low levels of pests on the crop. You also potentially can establish large numbers of natural enemies before the crop comes in the greenhouse, so that they really can maintain a very low level of pests because there's so many natural enemies already in the greenhouse. It avoids the costs, the shipping costs of weekly shipments and releases. It might be a reasonably simple thing for growers to do, and given the innovation that we're seeing in some growers around the country, it seems to be something that they're interested in doing. It must be simple. And possibly you can manipulate the number of natural enemies available in the greenhouse just by having more banker plants, it might mean more natural enemies. The first report I can find of someone using banker plants in greenhouses is Lisa Hansen in Denmark in 1983, in an IOBC bulletin, talked about the possibility of using Aphidolites aphidomyza on banker plants, a grass sort of banker plant, for aphid control in peppers. And these are just a couple photos that I've taken of banker plants being used in greenhouse peppers. Now, in greenhouse floriculture, as well as vegetables, we're already using this, and some growers are already using this sort of approach in a way. And these are slow-release sachets that a number of commercial insectaries have available. You basically have wheat. You have a sachet, a little sack, filled with wheat bran, and on that are feeding Tyrophagus putrescentii mites, acarid mites that are feeding on the bran, and feeding on those mites is the predaceous mite, either Amblyopsis swirskii or Neocelus cucumeris, are the two most common now. And these bags are put out into the crop, and 4 to 6 weeks of time you can produce cucumeris or swirskii mites from these little bags. So it's an open rearing system in a greenhouse that's commercially available. Spring, a number of us went to Holland to the IOBC meetings and saw this that BioBest was doing in chrysanthemum crops, where they basically have these ribbons of these are ribbons of cucumeris, or actually in this case swirskii. About every third bag in this ribbon was actually filled with something, and then this grower basically uses this boom to distribute these ribbons of cucumber or swirskii throughout the crop. And you can see here a ribbon laying on right on the crop. So fairly big modern way to try and do this. So what I'm going to talk about today is a little bit of work that we've been doing, various projects we've been doing in my lab, looking at options or ways, evaluating the possibilities of using banker plants for insect control in greenhouses. The first one I'll talk about is using marigolds for aureus insidiosus. The next I'll talk about some evaluation work that we did with Roy Van Driessen in Massachusetts to look at banker plants for aphids. And then finally, I'll mention my graduate student, Du Hyung Lee, who is working as looking at eggplant as trap plants or possibly banker plants for whiteflies in poinsettia. Okay, so Linda Berge is a Swiss student that did her master's degree with me a couple years ago, looking at the possibility of using marigold plants, especially flowers, for aureus insidiosus, which is a wonderful predator. It has advantages over cucumeris or swirskii for thrips control, because swirskii and cucumeris only kill the young stages of thrips, and aureus will kill all of them, all the motile stages, that is. And so it could be a very good predator. We just need to get it to hang around in greenhouses, and especially in the absence of prey. Now, there an anecdotal report at Cornell in Boyce Thompson Institute. They had they were trying to get biologic control of thrips with aureus on potatoes in a research greenhouse, and these data just tantalized us. They had no aureus in these two greenhouses with fairly high thrips population counts, and where they released aureus and marigold with one release with marigolds in the greenhouse. They sustained for at least 9 weeks fairly good thrips control. It's definitely doesn't say that it was the marigolds responsible for this, and it's not replicated, but it was enough for us to say, well, let's just take a look at this. And so what Linda did was the first thing was just compare the production of aureus, the population increase on different cultivars of marigolds, and essentially what she found is that she couldn't reproduce aureus on marigolds, and that was a bit of a disappointment. And then we began to look at why potentially, and she ultimately, I won't go with all the research, but she ultimately looked at the pollen that that aureus would feed on, and looked at longevity and fecundity on that pollen versus other pollens versus other arthropod prey. And these are her results. Through time, this is the daily number of offspring produced by aureus insidiosus females on these five different diets. She combined maple pollen, or the data from maple pollen and bee pollen, and actually garden impatiens pollen here. A diet of thrips was obviously the best for the entire time. A diet of Hephaestia eggs sustained them as well, but marigold pollen was no better than the control pollen. In her study in terms of reproduction. And then if you just simply look at adult survival, the same thing happened. They did fairly well on other kinds of pollens through to day 16. And with thrips and Hephaestia eggs, they did quite well. Marigolds, however, again, were no better than just the controls. So they really weren't being sustained. So our conclusion is that the aureus insidiosus females didn't reproduce well nor live very long on thrips-free marigolds. If you add thrips, if thrips are in those flowers, it'll probably sustain them, but we don't want thrips in the flowers. And so we just said that marigolds are probably not appropriate banker plants for aureus insidiosus. Now, there are some other options out there. There's a lot of interest right now using black pearl ornamental pepper. We do know that aureus can be established in pepper greenhouses, and black pearl is an ornamental pepper that produces pollen which will sustain the thrips or the aureus, hopefully. And so this is being looked at in a fairly big way in some greenhouses in Ontario and other places in Canada that I'm aware of. You can see the row of peppers there, and just a banker plant there. So I think we'll be hearing more about that. So then I'll talk a little bit about what we did for aphids, evaluating banker plants for aphid biocontrol. In this case, you've got grain aphids of various, either bird cherry oat aphid or Cetobian avineae, which don't infest plants other than monocots. And so they're not going to infest most of the other crops grown in greenhouses. The host range of the natural enemies you use on these aphids, however, on these banker plants, it's got to include these aphids as well as other pestiferous aphids in the greenhouse. You also need a continuous supply. I mean, one banker plant isn't going to last forever, and so growers will be continuously growing barley or oat or wheat or whatever, as well as the aphids, and then add them into the greenhouse through time. And this system is available commercially. You can buy these banker plants, or you can do it yourself. And the natural enemies that would have been looked at least being available commercially, include several of the braconid parasitoids, Aphelinus abdominalis, as well as Aphidolides, Aphidomyza, and actually some syrphid species. And you can see here just a photo of a banker plant with lots of aphids, including parasitized aphids. And this is some photos that I took in Finland, just showing some of the commercially available banker plants in this clancho crop. And this is some examples of a do-it-yourself where growers themselves are growing these. This is just some rye or barley growing in a headhouse of a grower's greenhouse in British Columbia. And this is where he keeps his aphid colony. He simply puts, when the plants are big enough, he puts the aphids or the plants in there to get infested with aphids, and then he puts them into the greenhouse. And this guy is in Ontario. This is a potted plant grower in Ontario. Again, grows the plants out in the greenhouse, and then he's got a Pepsi cooler that he uses to infest the grain with bird cherry oat aphid in this case, and then he hangs these along structures out in the greenhouse, and he's got a drip irrigation system to make sure these things get irrigated. So this guy is serious about doing this. And so some work that Roy Vandriche and I did looking at evaluating these under spring crops in greenhouses in New York and Massachusetts, we looked at, we used one banker plant. I'm only reporting on the stuff we did in New York, where we did it in four different greenhouses. Anyway, one banker plant per 400 square feet was what we used. We released 25 Colomani parasitoids onto each banker plant, and then we had flats of pansies outside of a cage in the greenhouse, and then flats of pansies inside a cage in the greenhouse. And then we counted the numbers and these pansies were infested with green peach aphid. And so this is the results that we got. I'll go through this very quickly. We stopped counting the control plants because they were dying of aphid infestation. This is one where it worked quite well. The grower was very attentive to the whole project, and it worked very well. How much time do I have? 1 minute? Okay. The control happened partially because of the banker plants, but we had syrphid flies that invaded the banker plants and the pansies and gave good control in this one. So it's hard to tell how much the banker plant directly was involved in controlling the aphids compared with the syrphids. This one is the one where it really didn't work very well. The level of control was better than it was in the cages, 500 average aphids per little tiny pansy plant, but the problem that happened here is some of the challenges that we learned. First of all, you need an abundant level of aphids at the beginning, and we didn't have that. Most of the growers completely forgot to irrigate their banker plants. I don't understand that, but that's what happened. And it's hard to sustain anything on a dead plant. And then we can play with banker plant density and temperature effects, which can be a problem with some parasitoid species, and the aphid species complex. The aphid species complex that we ran into is, we found out, we learned in this trial that about 28% of the aphids samples that we saw were foxglove aphid, and Aphidius colomani doesn't touch them, which caused a problem in the rest of the greenhouse. Okay, because of the time, I'm going to, just a picture of foxglove aphid, I'm going to stop there so we can stay on schedule, but let me show you one more thing. No, there it is. That's it. Okay, so Mr. Do Young Lee is going to be giving a presentation on basically where he is with trap plants for white flies on poinsettias, and some of his work eventually, hopefully, will be looking at parasitoids on trap or banker plants as well. I'll leave it at that. All right, so.